From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. We humans have a deep need for community, none more so than we humans who are living outside our places of origin. The power of community organizing is twofold. We not only make ourselves feel like we fit and belong in a place, but it also helps us discover more about ourselves. The overseas journey of my guest this week, Abe Sorok, began as a member of the Moisha House Project, which sent him down a road of self-discovery. Did he help to organize the community, or did it organize him? His current work with the Global Shapers Project is an extension of this idea, the need for community to help with mentorship. As Abe notes, with younger expats, there are usually lots of folks around who are either in your age cohort or who are just really senior. There's a shortage of mid-level role models and advisors, so community is necessary. This generation has witnessed massive change and has found themselves having to live in ways that nobody has taught them how to live before. And this goes double for those of us who are living overseas. And then there's the challenging notion that Abe brings up of people who have been outside the U.S. for the last decade. Are we the last Americans? I've been impressed with Abe and his work almost since we first met back in 2009 or 2010. Exact dates and events from your first couple of years overseas can be a bit hazy thanks to all the partying and social lubrication. But we've constantly bumped into each other at events and out on the old neighborhood over the years, so I've had an inkling of what he's been up to since our heady party days. But this conversation was a great way for me to learn more about the nuts and bolts of his work, as well as the special challenges facing the global Jewish community. It's not something that I've ever thought of before, and our chat was a reminder of just how many different types of migrants there are out in the world, even within our own cohorts. I had my eyes open to some new ideas, and I hope that you find it just as illuminating as I did. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Abe Sorok. Abe Sorok, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Where is home?
Home is where my folks are, so that's Bethesda, Maryland.
Bethesda, Maryland.
Bethesda, Maryland, right outside of D.C.
That's where you're from originally?
So from D.C., grew up in D.C. for the first 10 or 12 or so years. Then
you were taxed without representation.
Somebody was. Yeah. But my folks moved out to Bethesda, and that was and kind of remains home. Those were the formative years.
Wow. I will say you are the first person to come on here and not say in some way that their home is where they are right now.
Well, interesting.
It is very interesting.
That's very interesting.
I will also tell you that this isn't... I would not say that to make you feel like you're an anomaly. I would just say it's a unique answer, but every single answer has been unique.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it blows me away. Everyone's got a different way to say it, which is one of the things that I have been learning as I do this.
What's the usual?
Well, you can't really say usual, but there will always be some way to say... This is the place I'm in. So whether it's Beijing or Shanghai or Tasmania or whatever, someone will say in some fashion that this is where I am, so this is home. And then they will somehow qualify it. You are the first person that has not qualified in any way. My home is where my parents are.
That's the truth. Yeah.
Well, okay. So this leads me – well, I'm going to come back to this, but let's get to how you got to where you are now, which is Beijing. So you're in Bethesda.
Yes.
What takes a nice boy from Bethesda to Beijing?
Man. Bethesda was high school, right? And then, I went to the University of Wisconsin. And when I was at Wisconsin, I picked up, Chinese as a major.
As one does in Wisconsin.
Yeah. maybe there's a story there too. I don't know. Professors, you know, but, have a good professor and they'll ignite something in you to get you on a path you maybe wouldn't have expected. So I ended up picking up Chinese as a major and came out to Beijing for the first time in 2008. Around the Olympics, and as anybody who was around here, you know, at that time can tell you, right? It's the dynamism and the energy was just intoxicating.
And you and I were arriving at the same time. Yeah, that was sucks you in.
And here we are, right?
Yeah.
So that was really something. And I also realized kind of how different China was and is from what we'd expected in the West, or you know, stay here for lifetimes and never learn everything.
I have to say about that, though, they were selling something during the Olympics. The Chinese were very consciously saying, this is who we are, we're coming out, we're opening up. And when you got here, you were like, they're not lying. Like, they make a marketing pitch and they are selling what they say they're selling.
That's for sure. It's a really interesting you know, just way to distinguish. I think part of it is also when you're coming out of college, like I was, you know, you never know how much of the way I see the world or whatever has been spending the past 10 years in and around China, or, you know, just leaving your 20s, entering your 30s, right? So it's just, I'm sure that if I'd showed up, if I'd been, you know, 30 in 2008, probably the way that I would have related to the place would have been quite different than...
I will tell you, as someone who was 30 in 2008, that it is not that way.
Interesting.
Now, actually, I think the way you're the way you're talking about it in terms of age, it's more really stage of life.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
So I think we were both in the same space. But so you're at Wisconsin, you're doing your thing, you're taking Chinese. What says go to Beijing, young man?
Well, so I mean, you know, I'd love to take credit, you know, for any kind of foresight, but you know what you did your junior year was you took a semester abroad. And so I came here for an intensive language program, spring 2008, stayed through the summer, which was the Olympics themselves, right? And then I went back to the U.S. to finish my degree, and then the financial crisis hit. And I was planning to go to law school, you know, poli-sci was my other major, you know, got the grades, did the LSAT, did the whole thing. And I decided, I remember I still wrote about this in my journal. I remember, you know, it was a whim. I applied to a graduate program in Nanjing, the Hopkins Nanjing program. And I said, you know, well, hey, if I want to defer law school for whatever reason, or, you know, if I don't get into the schools that I want to go, I can always just take a year and, you know, then I'll really have figured out China and then I can go back and I can do the whole law school thing.
One year, just figure it out.
That's, well, hey, you know, that's, what do you think when you're 20, right?
Yeah.
But that was the you know, backup plan, which quickly became the plan. And, I came out here, you know, back to Nanjing, I want to say, I guess 2009. And after that, I got a job in Beijing. I was a paralegal for a Western law firm. And based on that, you know, I realized I didn't want to go down the law school path. And by that point, I was just so engrossed in, you know, the kind of China growth story, the China development story, that it's kind of kept me here more or less ever since.
I can totally relate to that. So I actually came to Beijing. I came to China with the full intention of coming to China. Like, I was just wanted to come here. I heard the crazy voice in my head and I said, I'm going to China. No intention to leave, but right after I got here, we had the huge stock market crash that was September of 2008. So even if I had chickened out for some reason and decided I need to go back, I wouldn't, there was no way. Actually, the company I'd worked for before I came here, they went through a huge round, massive layoffs, you know, just crazy. And then they moved their office and all. So I probably would have lost my job anyway had it not happened the way it did. So it just worked out so well. Like the financial crisis could not have come at a better time for me, which is a horrible thing to say, but there was just a small hiccup of a slowdown over here, but then it just picked right up again because the Chinese government said, oh no, you don't.
Sure.
And they did a huge economic stimulus, all the railroads, all the bridges and tunnels and everything. So
no, totally. It's pretty interesting, actually. I think, you know, we, our kind of individual lives are the microcosm, but like what happened in 2008, especially as it relates to China and China in the world, or, you know, even the rise of expats and kind of migration, where it's like, you know, if you look at 2008, I think, and we can get into this or not, but it was really an inflection point in kind of the way that China saw itself and the way that the West saw itself and the way that people had to make decisions based on that is like, you know, where do you see your future?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, I've talked about this on a previous episode, but when I was here, I don't know if you remember this, or I don't know if you noticed it when it happened, but I believe it was 2009 where there was a huge influx of Spaniards.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So my circle of friends, there were a couple of Spaniards, and I remember they just stopped hanging out with us so much because they were so busy just kind of onboarding the Spaniards who were flooding over it because the financial crisis. And then, of course, the Euro crisis, basically it was 2009, 2010, hit them really hard. And there were these roving bands of Spaniards walking around the bar street and, wow, you know, in San Leighton. And I just remember it. And we had a couple of Chinese friends in the group and they learned Spanish because they wanted to meet all these new people. And they went to a house party and, like, quote, learned Spanish. I mean, these are people who already spoke 2-3 languages, right? Their home dialect, Putonghua and English. And they decide, oh, I'll just go do Spanish now.
Totally.
So they learn Spanish so they can start communicating with this new influx of people that are on the periphery of our friend group. I remember so clearly, one of them went to a party, two of them went to a party, and afterwards they said, these people, they didn't want to talk to us. Like, we learned Spanish and they're just not interested in talking to us. Like, they weren't, like, racist. They were there because they had to be, and they knew it, and they were looking just waiting for the opportunity for when they could go back. They needed to come here for work. And then as soon as they could, they wanted to go back. They had no interest in moving here to move here. They were here because this is where they could find work. And I remember being really slapped in the face with that because I was there. I was here, and I am here because I wanted to be here. And I found the opportunity that I could, I found a job. I could be successful at it. It was fulfilling. And I really loved being in the Chinese culture and learning all about this. And there was this other group of people that didn't want to be here at all. If they didn't have to be, they wouldn't be. And it was so fascinating. And what you just said about kind of where the future is and we're kind of a microcosm, you're absolutely true. But at the same time as we're experiencing this, other people are moving for other reasons. And that was the first time I really realized, oh, you don't always have agency. you don't always get to go where you want. Sometimes you can't stay home. I want to ask you about a couple of things. First of all, well, this is all kind of an under umbrella. You do a lot of organizing, community organizing, which is something I identify with a lot. I've done it myself. I met you. Actually, I don't even remember how I met you. Maybe we just met at common events. But I know the first time I really interacted with you in a meaningful way, I believe, was because of your involvement in Moisha House.
Oh, sure.
So can you talk a little bit about what that is? Because I tried to explain it to my wife, and I'm pretty sure I did a bad job of it.
Sure. So it's been a little while since I've explained it myself. But Moisha House, a very cool international organization that was set up to deal with the way that young Jews go through their stage of life milestones. And the challenge that they were setting out to address, this was founded, I want to say, back in California, maybe 2006 or so, and has since expanded to, you know, hundreds of houses across the world. Very, very cool, very successful program. And what they were trying to address was that young people are staying unmarried longer. And there were no real ways for, you know, once you get off of campus, there were no real ways for young Jews to stay involved in any kind of meaningful Jewish life until they had families of their own. And then they would start going to synagogue and all the good things. But in the meantime, you know, they were just kind of floating around out there, and there was no infrastructure for that. And so the Moisha House said what they would do is they would set up this series of kind of community spaces that people also would live in. They'd be homes, but they would have the mandate to organize and run these Jewish or Jewish-inspired events and build a community that way. And it's been a very successful model, a lot of wonderful people, great relationships, and we kind of helped to bring that to Beijing in the early tens.
You started it, right? Were you the first guy running it here?
No, I just I was actually, I think, part of the third generation of the house.
That's how I met you, because I went to the Halloween party at Moisha House. That's actually how I met you. That was a great party,
great Jewish party of all time.
Oh my God, it was fantastic.
No, they knew how to throw a party. That's, yeah, very, very cool. And of course, the Beijing flavor of the house, obviously. I mean, this is, you know, you talk about kind of a migrant experience, or kind of a what's the something more than expat, right? But like,
oh, yeah. Well, you know, I was actually going to say this because I asked you to explain it because I did explain it to my wife incorrectly, because the way you talked about its origins as being the kind of a space where young Jews can kind of maintain connection to the culture and traditions, whatever, even though they're not establishing families. There's realities of people are waiting long to get married and people are all over the place. It actually is such a fantastic way to, I don't want to say address, because it's not like a problem, but it's a fantastic way to kind of deal with the reality of the fact that people are migrating more. And I don't know, I kind of thought it was around longer. Like, when you said it was founded in 2006, I was like, I'm just thinking like all the Sephardic Jews. Like, there's a tradition of Jewish people just bouncing all over the place. And I'm surprised this idea wasn't out there already.
Yeah, well, I think the challenge of kind of our age in a lot of ways is setting up new, you know, kind of light and flexible institutions to deal with the way that people actually live.
Exactly. Well, that's a better way to put it. Like, it doesn't matter if you're talking about Jewish tradition, Jewish culture, or economics, or entrepreneurship, or anything. Like, you need kind of these structures, these systems to be able to move around with us or be there for us when we move, because absolutely, no one is staying in one place.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love it. And I will just say, the events you've done, I've really enjoyed the ones I've gone to. You have great speakers. You come in, and I have yet to go to a Seder. Like, that's one of the things I want to do, is come in for a Seder. Cause I've never been to one. So it would be fun.
Well, one of these days we got to get you in, but I want to, you know, just because I think it really does represent a lot of the coolest elements of some of what we're going to be talking about. I want to stick with the Moshe House model for just a minute longer, because I think what's so powerful about it is it connects, you know, kind of the most ancient traditions and kind of the deepest traditions to the most modern way that people live. And the thread is people. It's like the residents or the community builders who are kind of entrusted to do something with that. And it says, you know, we're going to take these values that are our values, that are our identity, and we're going to manifest it in this way that it's never had to be done before, maybe never could have been done before, you know, certainly not in Beijing, China, right? And one of the things that we did, you know, back in the day in the house, I think I moved out in 2014, but, you know, this idea that we would try to, you know, not just be for only the Jewish expat population or only Jewish people, but, you know, it would say, you know, it's a welcoming Jewish home. Where, you know, it's for folks who are Jewish, obviously, maybe it has that extra resonance. Maybe they want to come to, you know, holidays, something like that. But even for other people who are just curious or just who, you know, share the same values when it comes to community, when it comes to education, when it comes to sharing knowledge, building those relationships, that it was open. And that, you know, the idea was, you know, that would say that, you know, we're young Jewish people here in this community and we want to be good news. We want to make things, you know, possible for people. We want to help people connect, want to help people learn. And I'm very, very proud of that and grateful to the Moshe House guys for setting that up in a way that it could happen. But yeah, and I think that's a great example of, you know, that kind of just in time institution that was there when people were on the road and when people really needed it.
Yeah. I think we need a lot more of that. I mean, some of the people I've talked to, not necessarily on this show, but people I've talked to, there is a real yearning for community. It's one of the things that has been driving me to build Migration Media or just create a space, something, anything that can give us all a sense of belonging, or just that we, just to know that there's others out there. So I talk about this sometimes to other people is, when I did work in the vegan community here in Beijing. And one of the things that we noticed was as soon as we started doing events and people just started showing up. And one of the things that got said over and over and over again, someone new would show up to an event. I didn't know there were other vegans in town. Like, I had no idea. So to me, the idea of community is about finding those people, or not even finding those people, just recognizing that there are people out there who don't even know that they're part of a community. It's a community that doesn't even know it exists. And I love the Moshe House model, because it's like, if you're Jewish and you move to a city and you don't know anyone and there's no synagogue, how are you going to know that there are other Jewish people and that there's a way to stay in touch with your tradition and your community? Like I said, it could be anything, but the Moshe House model makes so much sense.
So a couple things about that. I want to add to that and then even go a little bit deeper if I think it might be fun thread. But to add on to that, we used to do something kind of consciously where we were trying to do something we called shooting up the flare. You know, so it's not just for people who already affiliate or already say, you know, I would seek out Jewish stuff. They come because the event's just cool.
Yeah, that's why I went. I'm not Jewish.
But, you know, I'm sure you recommended some people to go at some point,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, and then based on that, depending on how much folks resonated or related to it, if they wanted to be volunteers, if they wanted to, you know, we'd had people who would move in and become new residents. But it's because we shot up that flare and we figured out, you know, who would be attracted to that, because there's no way to really go out and find people in that same way. But if you run events or if you kind of, you know, get the word out, then you can attract people and then depending on how much they're into what you're doing, you know, deepen that relationship and that engagement. But one thing that we found too, because I know identity is kind of a big theme, is we would try to be very self-conscious of, and this was, I think, personal journeys for the residents, I'll speak for myself, what is being Jewish mean in, you know, the postmodern world, the fourth industrial revolution, you know, the post nation state, you know, all this wild stuff that's, you know, that we're living through, historically. And that's something that, you know, I think if, you know, certainly where I grew up or when I grew up, it didn't really speak to me that much because I was in it. You know, I was just, swimming in this, you know, Judeo-Christian cultural water. And I didn't recognize, you know, how that's actually kind of pretty unique until I came to the other side of the world and realized, hey, wait a second, you know, maybe some of my values and the way that I think and the way that I relate to other people has to do with some of these traditions.
The language I use for that is I call myself a recovering Catholic.
Yeah, sure.
It's like alcoholism. You never, even if you stop drinking, you're always in recovery.
You know, it's
like a filter in front of your eyes. Everything you see.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, when I came here, I think I came to maybe appreciate that filter a little bit more. You know, then, and that's something that I was kind of happy to share as a community organizer.
Well, so I'm glad you mentioned your own journey, because this is making me kind of think about, I guess what I want to ask you is, what is it? So when you got here, or when you kind of ran into this Moisture House concept, like, what did that do to you? Like, let me put it this way. Sure. I don't want to, you don't have to tell me the depths of your Judaism and how religious you were, but having that kind of cultural and spiritual affirmation, you know, what is that like when you're overseas? Does it feel like a port in a storm? Does it feel like a nice thing that you fall into? Like, what was that process like?
Yeah, man, totally fascinating question, and it gets to the heart of I think a lot of these, you know, the impact of some initiatives like this, and then also what it means to spend your 20s, you know, your entire 20s in a across the world. So I didn't grow up with really much Jewish identity. My folks are, you know, I come from I'm a product of a mixed marriage, you know, so like I didn't really grow up with, you know, going to synagogue or going to church or going to the mosque or anything like that, right? I just you know, they basically said, you figure it out. which is great. It's a very American thing. But then I came over here, and, you know, this kind of idea of any port in a storm, it was kind of like that, where, you know, it said there was this idea that, you know, here was a community for you. Here were some values for you. Here was something that could help you figure out, you know, what does it actually mean to be somebody who, you know, no longer has the training wheels of life, which is, you know, kind of the university system and the high school system before that. And that it would actually say, you know, and even all the things that people take for granted if they live back in their home culture, where there's the, you know, civic things that they could get plugged into, and this was something that, you know, that Judaism kind of, you know, stepped up and said, or the Jewish community stepped up and said, you know, actually we got something for you. We consider you one of us, and we consider you somebody that, you know, we want to make sure does okay. And here's a program. And of course, you know, I think like anybody, I that resonated extremely deeply, and I came to appreciate it more than, I'd imagined I would growing up. And that's just super, super cool.
It's very powerful too.
Yeah, very powerful.
As you're saying it, I'm like, damn, I wish I had a tribe, man.
Well, you know, but that's the other thing, right? And I think, you know, you've either got one, or you've got to build one, or both. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's that, like, you know, can you appreciate the resonance of some of these things. And then, you know, with business and with community, it's tapping into some of the deep human needs that people have, and then figuring out, you know, how do you serve those with the values? How do you serve those with the, you know, the fundamental concepts, whatever they are, whether it's, you know, this mobility or the freedom or the, you know, the caring, right? It's like, how do you make that real in people's lives? And if you don't, then it's just, you know, it's just going through the motions, and nobody wants that. But if you do, then it means something to a whole new generation of people, and they can find their own, you know, values in it, or find their own appreciation of it in a way that, you know, maybe if you'd asked them before, they wouldn't have predicted.
It's also going to be something that is very attractive, or I'm just speak for myself. Like, I'm feeling a little bit jealous. Like I said, like, man, I wish I had a tribe. But it's like, we're all looking for community. And totally. this almost isn't even about living overseas. I mean, this is kind of about what happens to young people, and even migrating with your own country. You know, if you go from city to city or whatever, you've got to establish some kind of community. And I don't want to say it's easier if you have an outpost that you know you can go to.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things that religion has served. That's one of the purposes religion has served.
Oh, absolutely.
Is it's helped people organize themselves and create a sense of community. So, like, if you're in the Middle Ages and you for some reason have to go from place to place, which didn't happen very often, if you had to migrate for some reason, you knew that if you were of that religion, you could go to that outpost of that religious sect, and you could that ready made community just plug and play. And we don't have that yet. Like, in this new age, like you were talking about, the post-industrial 4.0 and the post-nation state, we haven't figured it out yet. What is it? And maybe the Moisture House is kind of like a glimmer of, like, this is what you could have. And we have to figure out how we can make that work, or how we can create that for other groups.
Yeah, I that's really interesting and extremely meaningful. I'll say, you know, one thing I think is pretty interesting is, you know, it goes back to identity and then why do people do what they do? But like when I came to Beijing, like Moshe House wasn't that, you know, it was an idea, but then it was my work. And then it was the work of, you know, my roommates and colleagues, you know, that really made it something that,
no, but that makes sense. That's who you are. That's totally. Who we all are.
So. Well, yes and no. I mean, cause that's what's so interesting, right? Is that who I would have been if not for these guys? Uh-huh. And so like, you know, that's the beauty of the kind of institution setup is that, you know, all of a sudden you can become that person because you have a reason. Whereas I think a lot of other people, you know, maybe anybody actually, really anybody, if, you know, they had something to plug into that would allow them to become themselves, allow them to understand themselves, allow them to build the skills and get the practice, especially in their early life, that's what, like, that's the coolest thing that you can do, right? Whereas if you, you know, just hand it to them, which I think actually maybe happens in the US a lot more, then, you know, it's a completely different thing to be somebody who's the beneficiary of, you know, 5, 10, 20 years of setup versus, you know, consciously recognizing, okay, I'm going to plant a tree that hopefully people will be able to sit in 10 years. Whereas, you know, if you're back in the US, a lot of times it's a forest. But what I think people don't realize is like a lot of the trees are dead.
Yeah.
You know, and like you better start planting and thinking about it that way.
Or there are no trees.
Or there are no trees, yeah. But like, you know, like somehow like weirdly like you kind of think that there are, but like, but it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Right. No, this is interesting because one of the themes that's come up on this show over and over again is this idea of as international migrants, as expats, we take ourselves out of our home cultures, our home systems, and we're kind of adrift. Like I've often talked about it in not saying the word retirement, but kind of like what's next, what's the future hold? And really it's about grasping for how do we plan our lives? How do we, you know, when we're in our home cultures, we have kind of guideposts, you know, even if it's not, you must do this. It's like, okay, this period in your life is kind of when you get married. This period is when you buy your house and this is, you know, and you work your job for this time and then you retire at this age. Like those signposts are there,
absolutely.
But when you take yourself out, you don't have any. So how do we figure out what's next for us?
It's
and it could
tough.
Be spiritual, it could be professional, it could be geographic. Like, you know, we have to learn on our own and we have to learn from each other. And how do we do that? And I think, you know, a place like Moshe House is a great way to start. I want to move on because as we're talking about Moshe House, I'm thinking about what you're working with right now and it's very similar.
Yes.
But in kind of like, would you say in entrepreneurial ways about, tell me what you're doing, Global Shapers, right?
Yeah.
You need to explain this to me because I actually don't know what this is.
Okay. So I think you're right. And I think you're right to tie these two things together. So Global Shapers is a youth social impact initiative under the auspices of the World Economic Forum. They do Davos, they do AMNC, they, you know, get different stakeholders together at the upper echelons of, you know, human society. And they also, you know, I learned this, you know, kind of over time. They also cultivate a lot of other communities. And one of the communities that they've been cultivating is called Global Shapers. And it's a really beautiful project. I think there's about 8,000 shapers distributed across something like 400 hubs. And hubs are based in cities. And so, you know, most of the, you know, big cities on the planet now have Global Shapers hubs in them. And the hubs are comprise 30 to 50 usually young people between age 20 and 30, maybe a little bit over, who are dedicated to driving social impact, whatever that might mean to them. And so they work together in teams, on teams, as hubs to basically, you know, think of what their society or think of what their city needs and how can they, you know, provide it. And that's an amazing, you know, again, another one of those opportunities where, you know, they set up a structure, they'll set up a goal, a vision for you. And then, you know, people kind of have to build the skills and build the relationships that they need to start making something out of it.
So this is kind of like creating a space or creating a community that speaks to the people who are in these places who are looking for ways to make a difference.
Absolutely.
Build community, make change, all the energy that's out there. If you're not in your home space, you're kind of like, how do I have an impact?
Well, so that's why I think kind of so of course, most of these people who are shapers, I don't know what the stats are, but most of them are in their home country.
Okay. Well, I guess we're a little unique because in Beijing...
Well, we're extremely unique. Yeah. We're extremely unique. And that's true of the Moishe House and it's true of the Global Shapers because, you know, it's like... And if you talk about China and Beijing, China, which is the most exciting city of the 21st century and the most important one, you know, it's the Jerusalem of the East, right? It's like, you know, what happens here matters a huge amount.
Yeah, you can have a Shanghai that's your financial capital, but nothing happens in Shanghai without Beijing saying okay.
I had a buddy actually who I met through the Shapers who said... Yeah, I was saying, you know, I love Beijing, but I'm not sure if being there is the best thing for my business or, you know, if it's the right place for me to be. And he said, you know, China could have, you know, 50 Dalians and 20 Shanghais, but there's only ever going to be one Beijing.
Right.
And I really dug that. And I believe that's true. And that's part of what's kept me here. And so if you look at the, you know, the Moishe House organization or the Shapers here, this idea that, you know, it's an international group of people who come out of, you know, traditions that are maybe Western traditions. And they'd have to figure out, it's like, okay, how do these traditions or practices or how do these communities, you know, survive, thrive, and have something to offer, something to contribute, you know, here in Beijing, here in China. And I think, you know, it's they have a ton to contribute, is obviously my personal perspective, but then also what the participants get out of it is extremely unique. So, you know, I think in the Jewish community, there's not really a ton of people who have Asia expertise. We've probably got, you know, 1,000 Middle East experts for every Asia expert. And that makes sense, or it made sense, but it's not where the future is going to be.
I mean,
you know, and so that's one, you know, huge contribution that, you know, kind of having an outpost Moishe House kind of thing can make. And then for the Shapers, I think for me and for some of my colleagues, it's really become, you know, one of our main social communities here. Because, you know, there just ain't that much else to do, right? If you want to be somebody who's, you know, community building or leading organizations or leading projects, I'm pretty proud to say, I think as far as international is concerned, you know, Shapers in Beijing is probably like the best institution that you can work in.
And that's not me because you're ageist.
Hey, it's not my rules. I'm sure we can work on something, but it's just amazing how, you know, that community has come in to fill that need. And that's just, you know, if you're in San Francisco or if you're in Detroit or if you're in, you know, Buenos Aires and you are from those places, right? You know, the question is, do you want to, you know, go listen to a world-class comedy show? Do you want to, you know, go help your friend with the startup? Do you want to go visit, you know, Google head office or whatever? Or do you want to, you know, go watch a movie or do you want to go on a date or do you want to do a social impact project? And it's like, man, that's tough. Whereas here it's like, okay, social impact project, or you want to go back to the bar? And it's like, right. Like that's, you know, and what we can do with that is just amazing. And I think to the credit of the organization, a lot of the participants, people have been taking it very seriously.
It's funny, the way you said that, like kind of my knee-jerk reaction was like, hey man, there's lots we can do here. But then like, you're absolutely right. We've got such this collection of global talent in a city like Beijing who are, a lot of them are the top of their field. The best of the best. This is not a place you fall into, Beijing. This is a place you affirmatively decide, I'm going to go there. And if you want to make it in China, you got to come here at some point. Even if you're in Shanghai, there's going to be some connection to Beijing to make it work.
Totally.
And if you're here and you're cream of the crop and top of your field, whatever, there really isn't much for you to do besides work. Like, if you want to professionally develop yourself, you need to find an outlet for that. You need to find a place where you can do that. If you want to find a way to make a difference or how to take your talent and maybe move in a different direction or create something, you need to find a community. And there's only so many ways an accelerator can help you or a co-working space. You know, that's not very, it's not magic. You have to have a structure. And having something like Global Shapers sounds like the perfect venue for that.
Well, I think, you know, to the credit of the you know, the founders and the organizers and the folks who kind of put in the time to build it up to what it is, you know, both here locally and globally, I think it's an amazing program. And not to say that there's not a million wonderful, you know, kind of cultural and enriching things to do here in Beijing, but I think for anybody who's living outside of their home language environment, their home cultural environment,
it's tough. You need a little help.
You need help, and this is that.
Yeah. So I want to dig a little bit on about you here because we touched on this with the Moishe House and what that's done for you. So I'm wondering with the Global Shapers, what's that's done for you? So I kind of see the Moishe House as being like that affirmation that you have a community, and then how did you get into Global Shapers, and how has that helped your identity?
So one thing I think is super interesting, and I know that, you know, we've talked about this a little bit, you and me, and it's something that I think you feel very strongly too, is like, you know, if you either have a community or you got to create one. And that's, you know, I think what I've really appreciated people's opportunities that they've given me, you know, through Moishe House and through Shapers is like, okay, you know, here's a good reason, right? Here's some structure. Now, you know, make this what you want it to be. And I think I've been extremely fortunate to have some opportunities to do that, you know, in my time in Beijing. Moisha House, I think, was kind of more personal journey stuff. And I was also younger. And now The Shapers, which I've been more involved in over the past couple of years, has really been much more about professional development. And I think one challenge that you know, foreigners have here in China is it's tough to have mentors. You know, we you know, sometimes you've got, it's funny actually, just the way that the age distribution usually works of expats here, is you'll have a bunch of peers your age, and then a small number of, you know, very senior executives who sometimes will take you under their wing, kind of mentors, even sometimes surrogate parents. But you don't really have a lot of uncles. You know, there's nobody to say, you know, hey, watch out for this. You know, are you sure you guys should be dating? You know, are you, you know, hey, you know, you're gaining a little weight. You know, I mean, stuff like that, right? And like, you need that. And if you've got this in, you know, the US or in the West, you know, you're going to see some folks like that. You're going to be able to look up and say, you know, okay, this is my boss. He went to the same school as me. You know, he's 4 or 5 years older. Here's how he's doing it. You know, you sit back, you take some notes. You walk down the street, you know, you're looking at 100 other people who, you know, more or less share enough of your cultural background that you can compare yourself meaningfully and see how you're doing. And here, it's not really like that. And it's, you know, so the value of these communities as a way to kind of start orienting yourself more consciously, and then also being plugged into these communities around the world, that all of a sudden, you know, you get a sense of a broader world. And so that's been something that I think has frankly helped me a ton.
It's like finding those guideposts, those signposts that,
exactly,
that you need to see the people and to have them kind of show you, if not show you the way, at least show you an example.
Exactly. You know, and you can choose to go left or right, but you got to see the signposts.
Exactly.
Otherwise, what are you even doing? You
know? Exactly.
So it's super, super powerful. And just to kind of add to that or piggyback off of that, is I think, you know, a lot of the time, just based on, I think, our, you know, kind of shared generational experience coming out of the U.S., it's, you know, we weren't really taught how to do what we're forced to do now, and what I think everybody in the world is forced to do and increasingly forced to do when it comes to, you know, building new lightweight institutions. It was much more about getting good grades, you know, getting good marks on your company review, you know, stick around, be patient, get promoted. You know, like we've figured everything out. And like now, you know, between 2001, 2008, and 2016, it's like pretty obvious that nobody knows what to expect.
What you're saying is resonating with me. All the instability and anger and discomfort and disquiet that's happening out there in the body politic of the world is really all about this. Everything we thought was the way it was supposed to be, it just isn't that way, and we're all trying to figure it out. And I think people like us are kind of on the cutting edge. I don't mean us like because we're smarter. I mean because we're kind of out here.
It's like, you know, and whatever happens to us, it's either take this as a lesson or a cautionary tale.
Exactly.
Right? Like, but people should be thinking about this.
Exactly. Because
anybody who thinks they're in an institution that's not going to go under some turmoil has another thing coming, although I don't know how many people are left like that. And the question is just how skilled are you at adapting to this new world where it's like you've got to create a community from scratch, you've got to create a project from scratch, you've got to create a business from scratch. What are those skills that allow you to do that?
So where does that take you? What's next for you?
I keyed on, you know, pretty early, although I didn't know what to do about it. But I think people in China, especially foreigners in China, I think we share a really interesting challenge. I'm not sure how unique it is, but I'll articulate it, which is, you know, we're smart enough to know that there's a big problem, but we're not skilled enough to actually be able to fix it. And so, you know, for me, I there were a couple of different projects I wanted to do earlier on in my time here that, you know, I wanted to help, you know, to more folks be able to connect and exchange and, you know, different business things that I saw that would be awesome if we could do it. But I didn't realize, you know, how hard they actually were. It's like any young person who's trying to start out. But I think, you know, the way that I see it now, and I'm very proud of a lot of what I've been able to do here, but then, you know, even more so perhaps like the skills or the mindsets that, you know, being able to, you know, like I feel like I could be dropped anywhere in the world and, you know, build a cool business and build a cool community now. And that's kind of, I think, what is next, right? It's some of the stuff that I'm working on professionally, some of the communities that I'm part of. I don't think I'll be in China forever, in Beijing, you know, for even that many more years. And so how do I take the lessons that I've learned as a founder, as a creator, as a community builder, and then, you know, be able to take that into a environment, you know, with some of these lessons, with some of the resources that I've been able to you know, scrape together over the past few years and really build something out.
Do you feel like you could go back to Bethesda or back to DC?
I mean, I don't think I'd, you know, I could go back to the US. I think
you even want to? Yeah.
Well, Bethesda and DC, I think, you know, are wonderful places. They're, I think it's a great place to be like in your 50s and 60s and rich. I don't know if it's a great place for your early 30s. Maybe it is. But, I mean, for me, just kind of my personal interests and my professional business interests, probably thinking more like New York, San Francisco, or Austin.
Okay. But you could see yourself going back to the U.S.
Well, so this is another fun one, right? It's, you know, I know a lot of people are going to be listening to this. I hope they're not mad. But, you know, I feel like to some extent the expats here are the last Americans, you know, because we didn't go through, you know, what happened in 2016 where like the country just became so polarized. And that's really, that's like, it's hard for me to relate, you know, to like the visceral level. You know, I have my folks calling up and they're saying this happened. I'm like, oh, you know, okay. But I know that if I was in the U.S., I'd probably have had 100 water cooler conversations for every one, you know, conversation I've had here about, you know, what's happening in the U.S. politically or
gone a few protests, written a couple angry letters.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. But, and that's what I think is going to be really hard to relate to. And I'm, you know, I can like my imprint of American politics, isn't even, you know, the 2010s. It's the Clinton years. You know, and for me, it's really hard to imagine. You know, I read the Times. I look at the news. But it's hard for me to imagine, you know, I think how visceral and how deep kind of the cultural pains and tensions are. And I think that's one thing that I'm pretty concerned about, that, you know, you kind of can't go home again.
Beyond politics though, I'm pushing on this button a little bit, because the way that you've talked and the way that we've talked about some things, it really makes me feel like you have found a lot of yourself and found a lot of value and maybe even self-actualization out in an environment that is the international migrant world. I mean, it's all about finding your own way. It's all about building your own community. I'm just curious, because I think of myself in some of the same ways. Like I love the community building. I love being out here in the world. I can't imagine going back to the U.S. right now. I was just back in my hometown and it was great to be there for a few days, but man, I was like, I can't imagine being back here.
All right. So two, three things on that. One is a Clintonism that he said, you bloom where you're planted. And I think there's something to that. I think if we were somewhere else, if we had to be somewhere else, if we'd never been out here, you know, hopefully we'd have done some cool stuff. I think some of the opportunities here have been unique, but, you know, you just go where you go and try and be good news. And I think that's something that we could try and hold ourselves to. Another is, no one is a prophet in his own land. And, you know, I think that's not a Clintonism. I forget who said that, but, no, it was Hamming, or he was quoting somebody else. But what I mean by that, what that means is, you know, if you're in your hometown, you know, you're too caught up in the minuscule issues. Whereas I think out here, you know, we really get to kind of focus on humanity, right? Our shared humanity. And what do people really need?
We're desperate for it. Yeah, please, yeah, right, please right. Be a human with me.
Exactly. And so, you know, like you get lit up by that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and this is why I think it's valuable to have this experience of being somewhere else's. You get lit up by that, and then you have that torch, and you can then carry it back to wherever you're from or wherever you go next. And you're just, you know, you're more empathetic. You're able to deal at a more fundamental level with people instead of being caught up with, you know, the hot issues of the day or the, you know, the myopia.
Well, I dread the day when you leave Beijing, but I look forward to you bringing all these life lessons back to the U.S. where we desperately need them. Abe, thank you so much for coming, and I really appreciate it.
Hey, this was a pleasure, man. This went too fast. We'll have to do it again.
Awesome.
Well, there you have it. I hope you learned as much as I did. If you want some more information about Moisha House or Global Shapers, or if you want to find local chapters near you to see about joining up, just click on the link in the show notes. And as always, you can reach out to me with any questions or follow-up conversations you might want to hear me do, or any topics you want me to explore with my guests. You can reach me via email at mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net. And of course, I'm on Twitter at ZAX2000. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.